You're listening to event audio from the Brookings Events Podcast, part of the Brookings Podcast Network. For more in-depth analysis and commentary from Brookings scholars and our guests, go to brookings.edu/podcasts or listen via Apple Podcasts, on Spotify, or your favorite podcast app. Don't forget to follow us on Twitter at Policy Podcasts.
Hello, I'd like to welcome everyone today to our webinar on citizenship and civics and civic education. I'm Fiona Hill, a senior fellow here at the Brookings Institution. And this is, as some of you may be aware, a follow-on from an event, a webinar that we did on May 4th with the National Commission on Military, National and Public Service, for the launch of their report on investigating how much more people can play a role in the life of the country. The National Commission was set up in part in response to the anniversary that's coming up on JFK's call to service next year. And we were delighted as Brookings Institution to be able to join forces with the Commission. And during the webinar that we had on May 4th, the issue of civics education, citizenship, civic engagement as an issue came up repeatedly. And so we decided that we would do this event within the following month. Now, of course, since we put this in motion, a lot of events have happened. And we're against the backdrop, in fact, right now, today, of the funeral for George Floyd down in Texas. This actually is occurring as we speak. And so we wanted to be very mindful of the weight of this occasion and the issues that are raised by all of the protests that we've been experiencing and many of us have been taking part in over the last several weeks. And we wanted to also then, in this context, address head-on issues of race and racial discrimination in education and in that sense of citizenship here in the United States. I wanted to introduce everyone today to our panelists, and then I'm going to turn over to my colleague, Avril Haines, who was a member of the National Commission. And we'll talk a little bit about how that got set up in 2017 and what the goals of the commission were. I'm then going to turn over to Ruben Brigati, who we're really delighted could join us today. Ruben has just left his position as the Dean of the Elliott School at the George Washington University. And tomorrow he leaves to go and take up a new position as the Vice Chancellor and President of the University of the South. We're very grateful to get him before he literally leaves Washington, D.C. tomorrow. So Ruben, thank you very much for joining us. Then turn over also to my Brookings colleague, Andre Perry, who many of you might have actually been catching on other webinars and out on the media. Andre is the author of a new book, Know Your Price, which deals with the issues of discrimination in education, housing, and in the urban fabric of America against African Americans and other minority groups. And Andre will have a lot to say on this topic. We'll then turn over to the Brookings colleagues, Richard Reeves, the author of Dream Hoarders, which talks about, again, also the problem of overcoming inequalities in education. And Richard's thought a lot about these topics. Rebecca Winthrop, who has another book. There's lots of people with books out there, which I hope that people will buy at the end of this. Hopefully it'll inspire you to go out and get copies of these books, which really give us a lot of blueprints for action here. And Rebecca has another book, Leapfrogging Inequality, which is also putting this issue of education and civics in a global perspective. And then we're really delighted to have joining us all the way from Arizona, Jonathan Capel, who is the Dean of the Watts School for Public Policy at the University of Arizona. And Jonathan Capel and his colleagues have already put into motion a whole educational program at ASU and the Watts School that deals with many of the issues that we're discussing today, which we think could be a very good model for other similar institutions across the country. So thank you very much, everyone, for joining us. We've got several hundred people here today. I've got a host of questions that we've already been sent in. I just ask people who would like to additionally ask questions to put them into the chat function. And we will then have a moderated discussion among the team. And thank you so much again, everyone, for taking part. So Avril, over to you, and thank you.
Thanks so much, Fiona. I really appreciate your attention, frankly, to the work of the commission and the remarkable panelists that you've assembled today and the commitment of Brookings to the topic of the panel. And frankly, even though this panel was planned before the current protests in response to the killing of George Floyd, I cannot think of a better time to discuss the importance of strengthening our democracy, the value of civic engagement, and the role that service can play in our society, helping us to unite and to address some of the unacceptable racial and economic inequities that exist in the United States. And I'll just start by giving, frankly, a brief introduction to the commission and then explain why we spend so much time on the role of civics education as it connects to service. And, you know, I think the main idea is really to hear from many of the panelists who are true experts on these topics. But Congress created the National Commission on Military, National, and Public Service, which is the commission I serve on, as Fiona mentioned, in the 2017 National Defense Authorization Act, and tasked it specifically to conduct a review of the military selective service process and also to consider methods to increase participation in military, national, and public service in order to address national security and other public service needs of the nation. And the commission, which is bipartisan, it's pretty unusual in certain respects, but in particular, it's the first time in history that a commission was tasked to holistically review all forms of service. And as a consequence, we were really able to take a look of service and its role in society in a more comprehensive way, frankly. And after 2.5 years of extensive research, public hearings, conversations with Americans across the country, going to different states, over 40 cities and so on, the commission released its report, Inspired to Serve, on March 25th, and you can find it on our website, which is www.inspire2serve.gov. But basically, in going around the country, we found people in every corner of the United States who are engaged in service, committed to strengthening their communities. But in a nation of 329 million, only about 7% of the population is engaged in service. And we've just not unlocked essentially the potential of service to address the critical national, local needs that we need to address and to reinforce what I think of as, frankly, the civic fabric of American society. And we propose in the report a vision of a nation in which service is the common expectation and experience of all Americans, when it's the norm, not the exception. But a vision of that breadth, frankly, requires an enormous investment, an investment in civic education, in service learning, in resources that promote awareness and access to service opportunities to everyone, and not just those parts of society who can afford to volunteer or who happen to know or are related to somebody who's engaged in service. And for service to really have the impact on our society that we believe it can have, it has to be inclusive and it has to be diverse. And our recommendations, of which there are about 164, provide a kind of a roadmap for the investments that are needed in our infrastructure by 2031 in order to realize the vision that we sort of set forth. And, you know, this vision is essentially one in which every American might consider a career in the military, in public service, or serving as an AmeriCorps member, making a difference while developing skills to help them in future endeavors, job, professions, other things. And one in which we have a diverse group of qualified individuals serving in the armed forces, minimizing the need for traditional military recruiting. 1 million individuals annually taking up federally supported national service opportunities, and modernized government personnel systems, attracting and enabling a diverse set of Americans with critical skills and new generations to enter public service. Finally, I'll just say a few words about the civics education piece. The commission, frankly, didn't set out to review civics, and it's actually nowhere mentioned in the statute. And yet nearly every conversation or meeting we had around the country included a call to improve civics education. In fact, one of our findings, based on research and related to the relationship between education and service, was that a high-quality civics education plays a critical role in creating informed and engaged citizens who are more likely, as a consequence, to pursue service throughout their life. And yet, as Rebecca's writing, frankly, on this has indicated, we are seeing declining levels of civic engagement around the country, a trend that started several decades ago, and we need to reverse that trend. And it's not all that surprising in some respects. If you look at the resources we've invested into civics education, what we found is that annual federal funding for civics education declined from about $150 million in 2010 to about $5 million today that's available in discretionary funds from the Department of Education. Others. The federal government spends, it's said, $54 per student for STEM education, which I think is very important, but it shows what we can do when we are actually focused on a problem, as opposed to 5 cents per student on civics education. And less than 25% of eighth graders were rated proficient in the latest national civics assessment. So we included recommendations in our report to strengthen and expand civics education in America so that by 2031, our vision is that all K through 12 students are exposed to civic education, and all fourth, eighth, and 12th grade students test at or above proficiency in the National Assessment of Educational Progress test in civics. And we recommended, and this is the one place where we put basically numbers, you know, here is a dollar amount that we're recommending to Congress be put aside. But we recommended that a civics education fund be created at the Department of Education that provides $200 million annually in seed grants to state and local education agencies and higher education institutions to promote civics education, applied civics, service learning, including teacher training opportunities, and a portion of funds reserved for school districts in high need communities. So just to make clear, like, part of our thinking was, how do we make sure it gets to everyone? And so the commission proposes that at least 50% of the civics education grant funding be reserved for programs at high need schools. Furthermore, while grantees from non-high need schools will be required to match grant funds, this requirement doesn't apply to high need schools. And finally, the commission explicitly recommends including nonprofit organizations as allowable grantees with the aim that nonprofits can support their local community schools and may not have enough, frankly, administrative support to apply for or manage a federal grant. So we also, you know, we have recommendations to promote the adoption of high quality civics education by increasing federal incentives, piloting innovative approaches, sharing best practices, a whole series of things that we get into in that space. And I think in addition to that, as we also talk about service learning in the report as well, which is very much connected, and I'm sure we'll get into some of these questions as we go further, but a very much thank you for giving us an opportunity to talk about this.
Thank you very much, Avril. Ruben, you have been living this, certainly as the dean of one of Washington, D.C.'s most preeminent institutions. And, you know, you're obviously moving at a pretty very critical time in American politics and in civic life to a new position at the University of the South, which obviously one of the most venerable and older institutions in the south of the country. And you're dealing with these kinds of issues on a regular basis, and it would be great to hear from you some of your thoughts in response to the findings of the commission and ideas on, you know, how we might be able to move forward in concrete ways.
Sure. Well, thanks, Fiona, and good afternoon, everyone. It's an honor for me to be part of this conversation with so many highly respected colleagues and see some of you again after it's been a while. And so let me just say a few things. So first of all, the one part of my resume that Fiona did not mention that is relevant is that I am an active volunteer with the Boy Scouts of America, which now accepts girls. And the reason that's important is that I believe deeply in the importance of civic education and community service and inculcating that in our young people as early as possible. I personally found for our family that Scouts is a fantastic way for us to do that. And I think it goes a bit to Avril's point that there are people every corner of our country that are doing this sort of work, but not enough relative to a rural population. And the pathways to doing so are myriad. The second thing I would say, when I was dean of the Elliott School, one of the things I would say to our students all the time is that my view is that we don't lack sufficient knowledge of most of the world's problems. What we lack is sufficient leadership. And leadership is something really quite specific. It's the ability to bring people together to solve problems in a way in which they would not do absent the application of such leadership. So as it relates to civic engagement and community service broadly, my worry is that we don't lack either a comprehensive view of the problem or an understanding of the resources, both financial and human, that are necessary to apply against it. And we certainly don't lack an understanding of how vulnerable our country is by virtue of our various fissures that can tear us apart if we don't actively try to work together to bring them, to heal them. My worry is that we do not have the sufficient political will in our country to be able to overcome the various hurdles that will lead us to enact many of these very basic recommendations. And I'll give you a few examples. On the one hand, civics, as you know, what our parents took it back in the day, seems innocuous enough. And yet, certainly, and this is certainly true in a higher education environment, runs right up against this question of full intellectual freedom. Because civics for some people actually sounds like indoctrination for others, because it presumes that there is a right way for us to approach the organization of our society and the values on which those organization ought to be based. Now, I'm very comfortable with that, personally, because I think that we can have any number of political differences about the, you know, the nature of what the size of government ought to be or various policies, but the very essence of a community has to be a basic set of values and assumptions from which we can all commune, right? But whether it's even just been, quite frankly, the massive public debate about the nature of the Common Core curriculum on everything from how do you teach mathematics to what ought to be in the appropriate literary canon that we're teaching our kids in middle school and high school, this question of how do we teach and what ought we teach as a matter of priority, our students from across the country about how they ought to relate to each other and what their responsibility is to the common weal, is not as simple as it sounds. It's not as simple ideologically as it presents. And the reason that is significant is that our ability to get to an implementation of the sorts of recommendations that the commission has articulated depends on politics. And it depends on our being able, and I don't mean partisan politics, I mean our being able to create a broad enough consensus that this is what we ought to be doing. I would submit that, as Fiona mentioned, the convulsion that our country is in right now as a result of the brutal killing of George Floyd, both in and of itself, but also for all that it recalls in our country, and also with Breonna Taylor, and also with Ahmaud Arbery, and on and on and on and on and on, can be a watershed moment in the sense that, I mean, it has launched protests around the world, the likes of which I would argue we have not seen ever. And the recognition that something is really deeply, deeply wrong in what ought to be the greatest democracy in the world. And if this is not enough to bring us together to say, you know what, we may not agree on everything, but we know that we need to fix this, then God knows what would be. The final thing I would say is when I was dean at the Elliott School, I made it a point to emphasize the teaching of ethics in international affairs as a core component of what is needed to be an effective foreign policy practitioner. So we created something that we call the LEAP Initiative, the Leadership Ethics and Practice Initiative, which is led by one of Averill's colleagues, Chris Kojum, and Fiona's as well, that is meant to help our students orient their moral compass as it relates to their professional practice. And as we often said, we're not going to tell you what to think, but we want you to have sufficient insight so that you know what doing the right thing feels like. And my hope is that given the individual rugged individualism that is in the DNA of our country, more people in positions of authority and responsibility will assume responsibility to try to start those conversations in their respective institutions, whether institutions be colleges of higher learning or their institutions be a local coffee shop, because all of us have a role to play in our respective communities. And my hope is that we will take the most of our individualism as free people and take responsibility for it as a means of trying to build common bonds of community. So thanks very much.
Thank you, Ruben. I couldn't agree more. And Andre, I mean, you've been writing about some of the barriers to actually implementing this for some time. You know, institutions may actually get the will to make change, but often resources become a problem. And I know you've the theme of your book, Know Your Price, you know, is very much analyzing and also cataloging and describing all of the problems that many communities here across America and within communities are facing. That, you know, Ruben talked about people across the country, you know, feeling a kind of a shared sense, but even people in small towns and large cities don't feel that they're part of the same community because of divisions that are brokered as a result of economic inequality or, you know, racial divide. So Andre, I would love to hear your thoughts on this issue as well.
Yeah, and thanks, Fiona, for that. And I sympathize with a lot what Ruben said. I was a former dean that actually managed charter schools in New Orleans. So I have a lot to say about this. And I also managed those schools in the aftermath of Hurricane Katrina. And so I know that times of crisis give institutions an opportunity to assess what matters most. And it's not hard to notice that democracy is in deep trouble. Trump's winks and nods to white supremacists, voter suppression, hyperpartisanship, and the rising distrust of government suggests a lacking of basic knowledge and care for the principles of a democracy. Over the last few decades, education reform has put a hyper focus on math and literacy skills at the expense of civic education. Without question, quantitative and qualitative literacy, as you heard, are critical for individual and community growth. But the advancement of academic skills void of democratic principles will have the country move further into a land of anomy and dissent. Education isn't just affected by this problem, it is a part of it. Tribal battles around charter schools, so-called intelligent design curricula that disavow science and as well as school-to-prison pipelines are both causal and symptomatic of a sickly democracy that educators have a responsibility to heal. In the face of nativism, anomie, and extreme intolerance, it's clear that educators have a civic duty to return the educational system to its basic democratic aims. Educational leaders, as I said, must be responsible. But when it comes to creating anti-racist democratic communities, it's better to show than to tell, meaning society is better off when students see equity in funding and diversity amongst the ranks of educational systems, rather when they hear lessons about the importance of inclusion, civility, and good government. As a former school leader, we used to have students and teachers and communities engage in projects that occur outside of the curriculum. And in civics education, we talk a lot about projects. But it's clear that the projects that we should rally behind should involve something around deconstructing the structural racism that inhibit economic and social mobility among Black Americans. A lot of my research looks at these structures. The anchor project or research that of my book, Know Your Price, I looked at home prices in Black neighborhoods and compared them to home prices in white neighborhoods where the share of the Black population is less than a percent. And we control for all those things, the reasons why people say home prices in Black neighborhoods are lower. We controlled for education, crime, walkability, and all those fancy Zillow metrics you hear about. And what we found simply astounds that homes in Black neighborhoods are devalued or undervalued by 23%, about $48,000 per home, about $156 billion in lost equity, what that amounts to. That $156 billion should be going to individual families to send their kids to college, to start businesses. It should be used by municipalities to fund policing and vital services like education. I say this to say that you can't get to civics education or even a level of civility, basic levels of civility, if society has structures that inhibit the growth of African Americans and other groups structurally. So part of what my charge is to you is to say that, yes, we need projects that engender a sense of civility, a sense of civic education that goes beyond sort of the rote math and reading sort of lessons you get in school and that we emphasize. However, the projects that engage in civics education has to work on these structures that inhibit economic and social growth. So with that, I'm going to pass it off to the next speaker.
Thank you so much, Andre. I mean, that really frames actually very well, I think, Richard Reeves, who I'm going to ask to come in next. Richard's book, Dream Hoarders, talks exactly, as your book does as well, about these problems, across the United States. And Richard, I mean, I'll just turn it over to you to speak to this yourself, because you've been a very strong advocate of really trying to address all of these structural inequalities in education.
Right. Thank you, Fiona. Actually, my comments, I think, follow very much on what we've already heard. My work has looked at both inequalities of class and race and the way they intersect. And I'm now looking even more closely at issues around gender and sex as well. So I'll keep my remarks brief. There's three points I want to make, really, and this is in the spirit of the discussion. That I think we need to have at this particular moment. The idea of a social fabric or a civic fabric is a very attractive one to many of us. And of course, it can be something that unifies us, brings us together and serve justice. But I think we need to be honest too about the fact that sometimes the language of a social fabric or a civic fabric can be used as a cloak, as a way to cover up and to disguise the kinds of structural hard inequalities that so many Americans face. And so I think it's important to put that on the table in the way that Andre just did. It's not one or the other, of course, but I think that one of the reasons some people are skeptical about language around social capital, civic education, and so on, is they fear, not completely wrongly, that in the wrong hands, it will distract attention from the structural inequalities that we face. So it's in that spirit that I just make a couple of suggestions about how we think about both service opportunities and civics. I think we need the kind of service that really does promote equity and justice, and that does so in a couple of ways. One, in the opportunities that it provides for people to serve. How accessible are service opportunities to different people at different times? And right now, I think we'd all agree on this call that the way that service is funded and structured is not equitable, and we would need to want those service opportunities to be more equitable before I think we could responsibly ask for massive expansion. And so if we look just right now at the numbers, my colleague Sara Unzau is breaking these numbers for me, and many of you know these numbers better than me, but to take AmeriCorps as an example, AmeriCorps is, if you look at the alumni, it changes a bit over time, two-thirds white, two-thirds women, and two-thirds of AmeriCorps alumni had parents with at least a four-year college degree. A third of them had parents with a postgraduate degree. So I think we just need to face that lack of representation really clearly and do something about that. And I think it's also important at this moment to highlight the particular position of Black men, and obviously Andre's work. And if you're going to buy one book, buy Andre's new book. Really, I think, highlights some of these issues that right now, I think the particular intersection of injustices faced by men of color, in particular African-American men, is something we have to have at the front of our mind. And it's not only that Black men are less likely to be able to access or wanting to access these service opportunities in terms of civic service, but even in the military. Uniquely, there's a very big gender gap in military service. So the Black women are twice as likely to serve in the military as Black men. And there are lots of reasons for that, of course, but that's the other way around for whites, for example. And so right now, neither military service nor civic service is really reaching or appealing to the men in society who, as Andre and Ruben have both, I think, pointed out, are the ones who are in many cases the ones who are most concerned in terms of upward mobility and opportunities. I also just think in terms of the processes of service as well, it's crucially important that when service is delivered, it's delivered in a way that is that gives voice to and power to the least advantaged communities that we have and that are genuinely collaborative. and lift up and revalue those communities. And that's obviously something that needs to be baked into the design. And then the last point is more about civics. What do we mean by civics and civics education? What are we educating people for? And are we educating for justice and equity? And I think there is a danger sometimes, and Andre was just talking a bit about civility, but I think I know what he meant by it, but other people use that word differently. What other people mean by that is you shouldn't protest, you shouldn't dissent, we don't want conflict, we don't want anger. And that is not what it's about. Civics can never be and should never be about civility. Civics in a vibrant democracy is all about dissent when it's appropriate. It's all about righteous anger. It's all about collision, it's disagreement. It's all about creating a space within which we can fiercely disagree with each other, protest for civil rights, and do so on the basis of a profound respect for each other, even as we fundamentally disagree with each other, even as we struggle towards a better way of doing things. It has to be on the basis of respect, because respect and disrespect are some of the things that we're lacking on the one hand, and we have to build this sense of respect, because Andre's work on devaluation, I think, is the other side of the coin, the racist coin of disrespect. And so we need a civics and a service that promotes the right kind of dissent based on profound respect and equal valuation of human life in every way.
That's great, Richard. Thank you very much for underscoring those points. Rebecca, I mean, this is also a debate in other settings internationally, and we've had quite a few questions that have come in about, how do others, say, in Europe or worldwide define these issues too? I mean, I think, what Richard just said there about this being really more about engagement as a citizen, not just, as you said, it's not about civility, it's about how do you find ways of disagreeing with each other in a respectful manner and being politically engaged without, basically being disrespectful at all to any of your fellow citizens. And, how do we see other countries dealing with how they enrich the civic fibre of their democracies or in other settings? And, we've had a lot of questions from people about other successful models of a kind of civic education approach that we would like to adopt here, and service from other countries that that we can look to. And Rebecca, obviously that's something that you've been working on very closely.
Yeah, thanks. Thank you, Fiona. And I think it would be helpful just to think a little bit before I get to the other countries about the place of public education in the United States, because service learning is very important and helpful. By and large, not that many people in the U.S. participate in it. And I think the commission has said we want more people, which is great. Richard made the point, well, as long as it's equitably accessible, and one presumes that's because that it's poorly paid, and so people with not a lot of money can't afford it. But the core of how civic skills and dispositions have been developed for a long time has been through public education. And really, it was sort of the driving force mid-1800s, the father in the education world, the father of the common schools movement is a man by the name of Horace Mann. And his main argument was, mid-1800s, a new republic was, we have all these sporadic schools here, there, and everywhere. If we're going to make people who can live in a republic together in a democracy, we have to invest in making Republicans, not the political party, but people who live in a republic. And that is really the spirit of the American public education system in terms of its purpose. And I think that we have moved away from it. A lot of it is to do with the Sputnik moment and a worry that we're not doing good on science and math skills and STEM, which people have referenced. But I think there's a strong argument to make that, civic dispositions and skills are a 21st century skill. And it's good for the job market and it's good for being a citizen. And there's a couple of points I want to respond to before I maybe break down a little bit what other countries are doing and approaches. To Ruben's point about how political it is or can be, I have not had any leadership positions in universities and have watched from afar, and it is incredibly political, little p. But I have to say, in the K-12 space, there is a pretty broad agreement on the need for civic education skills and dispositions to be part of public education. There's a very, I'll give some examples. There's a very large coalition called Civics Now. And they have very conservative groups and very progressive sort of liberal groups. And they focus on sort of the Venn diagram on where everyone believes. And it's basically most people agree absolutely that you need civic knowledge. There's kind of three parts to any civic education. Civic knowledge, and that's really how does a bill become a law, which shockingly a vast majority of Americans can't even name the three branches of government. So this is very important, and it's when you talk about civic education, we talk about civic education. Most people think about your high school civics class. That is one part of civic education, and we have learned in the education community that that is necessary but not sufficient, actually, to create citizens. You need the knowledge and component, and then you need to do work in the public education system around values and dispositions. And that's around understanding what is civil discourse. I disagree with you, Richard, a little bit about civility. I think it's actually a skill to listen. Most people are being trained to speak and not to listen. Actually, we're missing that. So I do think it's an important skill. It's engaging with different people, a set of values. Ruben talked about ethics. You can certainly do that at age-appropriate levels across the K-12 spectrum. And then the third part of civic education, which the education community has come to realize, you need all three. You won't get the outcomes that are quite effective without them, is civic behaviors. And basically, young people need to be able to practice. What does it mean to meet with people who they are different from themselves, to have a discussion, to try to solve a problem together? And that's the part of civic learning that's very, very important, because you're out there practicing. And there's civic learning is one way to try to practice these civic behaviors that gives young people, we know from lots of evaluations, the confidence to vote, the confidence to show up at a city council meeting, the confidence to join the local PTA, whatever. There's many other ways in public education through, you don't even necessarily need a separate class. It's just changing how you teach, where you could set up a debate. It could be about any topic, history, science. You could do it on math. But the skill of debating is one. School government, having kids practice these behaviors in school government is another. Extracurricular activities are actually also great ways, if you have a sort of laced curriculum, into young person's leadership, teamwork, et cetera. So those are sort of the three big elements that civic education encompasses. And I would say there's a lot of great examples from outside the US, but more importantly, it's an interesting question that people were asking about models outside the US. I would point to models inside the US, because there's actually great models in the US. They are just highly underfunded. It was back to Avril's point. They're on the margins. When I look at the education community, the civic education advocates, nonprofits, teachers are the least paid, less money, have no comms staff. So I would say what we should do is actually tap a bunch of these really good models. There's great games. Sandra Day O'Connor founded something called iCivics, which is a game, video game around teaching how democracy works, how you work together. It's one of the most widely scaled civic education interventions. There's all sorts of great little pockets of models that if we could scale them up, I think would make a real difference. Thanks.
That's great, Rebecca. Maybe we can do another event that actually showcases some of these as well, because I think you're absolutely right. If they don't have their own communications outreach, then people don't get to know about them. It's just everybody individually knows of some of them. Not everything has the same reach as the Boy Scouts, for example. Now, Jonathan Capel from the Watts School in Arizona, you've got a great view of the Grand Canyon behind you. Please don't roll your chair too far back and go off the edge. But you have a really unique position at the university, at Arizona State University. You've got a very diverse student body, and you've actually tried to put this into practice at ASU, and you yourself have devised many programs at the Watts School. I think it'd be great for everyone to hear about what you're trying to do and how you also kind of work with the community there which is also extremely diverse and has some specific features that I think would be useful for people out here on the East Coast to hear about as well.
Thank you, Fiona, and it's great to be part of this conversation. And I will take Dr. Perry's advice that it is better to show than tell. And I think we do have something to show. But let me just situate a little bit, because gosh, what a great conversation. And there's so many interesting things that I think are directly relevant to what we've been doing here and trying to do. Let me start with something that Dr. Brigady said. I agree 100%. I've said the same thing. We're not wanting for solutions. We understand these problems. We actually know what to do, and a lot, we lack the will. I want to mention also, I actually think that we don't even lack the will. We lack necessarily the leadership, and we lack the skills and the understanding of how to implement some of the solutions that we want. In some sense, some of the things that Rebecca just talked about, we lack the practice in how to come together and solve problems. I've noted even in this past week how people have gotten better at running their protests because they've had several days to learn how to do it. And the protesters have gotten better at sort of regulating other protesters to keep everything under control. I mean, I've seen it with my own eyes. You need to learn how to do these things. Democracy requires practice. Dealing with conflict requires practice. And we've lost it because, and this I think gets at many of the comments, because our society has become so fractured. And the interaction among people who are different has become so fraught and so uncommon that we just are lousy at it. And I was thinking, as Rebecca was talking about Horace Mann, what summed it up the whole thing for me, she was talking about the values of Horace Mann and public education. Where I grew up, Horace Mann doesn't signal that. Horace Mann is a elite school for rich kids, private school. That's what Horace Mann is where I grew up. If that's not a metaphor for the way we've evolved, I don't know what is. So I think there are ways to get at this. What we need to do is to capture the very strong public spiritedness among young people today. And I think we're seeing evidence of that in the protests. If you want to find a silver lining, it's hard. But I think the outpouring of activity and emotion and engagement around what is obviously a crisis moment for our country is heartening, and I agree that this does seem like a watershed moment where something is possible, but it's possible because people care. So the question is, how do you take that idea and how do you take that will and translate that into action and give people the tools to be effective and use service as a way to create understanding and interaction, as opposed to what Richard said is 100% right, where service has actually become a divisive thing. Service programs are often elitist, and they don't create opportunities for a variety of people to engage in service activities and service learning. And even when they do, it segregates them into different activities. And so if we're going to expand service the way Avril and the commission have proposed, and I strongly support it, I think we need to multiply by a factor of 10 the number of positions in AmeriCorps. We need to better fund it, because the reality is, the reason why the statistics are what Richard said is because if you're supporting a family, if you're taking care of parents, if you have other responsibilities, you don't have the luxury of going and doing a year of service at a pittance pay. And so the people who get to do service are those who have the stability in their lives and the other resources in their lives to make it possible. So we need to alter the way that public service can be accessed by a broad number of people. I'm dean of something called the Watts College of Public Service and Community Solutions at a university, Arizona State University, that has taken as its purpose addressing the massive divisions in our society and the massive inequities in our society. And we start from the premise that a university should be seen as an instrument to address those things. Now, we think public service is part of the answer. Lots of universities have adopted public service as something that they promote, but in most cases, universities, quite frankly, feed the division, feed the elitism, are not part of the solution, are part of the problem right now, where educational credentials are handed out as a way to stride the world, and so we need to be against that. Public service has fed into that, to be honest. So what we've created at ASU is something called a Public Service Academy. It's a four-year program, very much premised on the idea that Rebecca talked about, which is giving people an opportunity to practice, giving them the skills, giving them the opportunity to engage in civic learning and solve problems. And by the way, one of the things we've discovered is the astonishing levels of ignorance that people have regarding the how a bill becomes a law, as she put it. I think of it as sort of Schoolhouse Rock, you know, guide to education. By the way, a bill doesn't become a law the way it's depicted in Schoolhouse Rock anymore either. So we need to update those videos too. But the premise of this four-year program is that young people need to be given the skills to engage. And by the way, that's about understanding the public sector, the private sector, and the nonprofit sector, because old understanding that you create a government program to solve it, that's not how the world works anymore. And that's part of the Public Service Academy. It means giving them internships in each of those sectors. It means creating mission teams where young people are given responsibility to come up with solutions, working in partnership with community organizations, mixing and matching people from different backgrounds to solve problems, whether it's issues around domestic violence, whether it's around access to education. We are very focused on the challenges of our Native American communities, and we could have a whole separate conversation. If you want to talk about injustice in this country, let's talk about, I think, an under-discussed topic of the Native American communities, which quite frankly, I think most Americans would be shocked if they understood the levels of poverty and dysfunction and pain in our tribal communities. But what's amazing to see is how the people who engage in these public service opportunities not only grow and not only gain skills, but come up with really good answers to really tough problems and are out there learning as they do good work. And so if we adopt this idea that public service can be a mechanism by which we bring people together, provide skills, get people on an educational pathway, I think we have the nuggets of a broad solution that we can get behind. Now, I want to offer one thing which I think is important. Public service doesn't solve anything if it's just this idea like go and sweep up a park, or you know, like ladle soup out to somebody. Like this idea that all you have to do is some sort of charitable works. Not that there's anything wrong with those things. Those are good things to do. So I'm not discouraging that. But there has to be a self-consciousness that what we are building is citizenship and civic competency, and embrace that idea. And I think you have to recognize the reality of what Dr. Brigati said at the beginning, which is those things are a little fraught, right? The idea that we have sort of an agreed upon set of civic principles, I think, reflects an earlier era, which we don't inhabit right now. And so that's going to be tricky. I also think that even when we did that in the past and had some agreed upon vocabulary of civics and so on, we didn't educate people regarding the historical context of those ideas. And so now people are struggling with, I think, an understanding of the frustration of part of the population because they don't have any historical context, right? So I've been struck, Dr. Perry, you obviously know this well. It's part of the story behind the home values. I've seen people reacting to stories about, you know, FHA redlining and all of the different things that were done to dispossess people of color, you know, the racist implementation of the GI Bill. I mean, we could go on at some length. And people look at that like, really? Wow. Like, how do people, educated people, how do you not know that? How do you not have any understanding of the history of this country? And so I think we can't just take civic education from 1950 or 1920 and import it into the current environment and think it's going to work. We have to figure out how to find common ground in that civic education and bake it into a public service. And we can do that. I've created a course on public service or to accompany public service. I think it's possible, but let's not pretend that it's easy. And I'll stop my filibuster now and look forward to the yield to the rest of the representatives here. Fantastic group.
Thank you very much, Jonathan. I mean, I know we have a very large group today, but you know, our intent with this as well is to try to, you know, kick off more of these discussions. The commission that Avril was part of technically wraps up sometime this summer, and their whole goal, you know, as Avril can say something else at the end, is to try to get others to pick up the mantle and to actually put this into practice. And you're already doing that, Jonathan, at ASU, and you hosted an event for the commission back in April as well. And, you know, we're hoping that, you know, we'll create some connections and networks just out of this event too. And maybe some of the people who are listening in, you know, will reach out to us too, and we can connect them, and they may have ideas that may, you know, help ASU, Brookings, and, you know, perhaps also Ruben as he goes down to the University of the South to kind of come up with ideas of things that, you know, we can all do to move this forward. I just wanted to go back to Richard, who I know wanted to just clarify a point that he made. But also, we've had a number of questions, Richard, not just about models from other countries. And obviously, you were very much engaged with this during the coalition government between the Conservatives and the Liberal Democrats in the UK as part of the Cameron Clegg government. This is one of the many issues that you dealt with there. And we've had a lot of questions about, you know, the role of government officials, local government officials and government officials at different levels, and, you know, kind of how they could actually engage more strongly on these sorts of questions. And others, we mentioned, Ruben mentioned being in the Boy Scouts of America. And Rich, I think you and I had once talked about, you know, Boy Scouts and the Girl Guides in the UK. Obviously, they grew up in a very different context. We had a question here about concepts of global citizenship that came in on the chat. And the Girl Guides and Boy Scouts, rather, in the UK grew up in a very imperial British context. And they did kind of, at the time, create a sort of sense of belonging to a larger commonwealth. There was a kind of an international perspective, but it was really one rooted in an early thinking about the British Empire. And obviously that's morphed over time, and the US Boy Scouts has moved in a different direction. But it would be really interesting to, you know, think more about how of these entities outside of the school that obviously are organized youth groups, and non-profits, junior achievement, all kinds of things have worked in other places, and that, you know, might also be woven in here. And then I'll go back to the rest of the group as well. But Richard, just adding some other things for you to think about, but I know you wanted to clarify one of the other points you made.
Sure, thanks. I'll be brief and try and respond to those. I think this issue, the local government point, and we certainly dealt with this in 2011 during some disturbances in the UK, and the research afterwards really demonstrate how important this kind of sense of place is for people. And I think the idea of the importance of place has been really reinforced by what we're seeing now with the pandemic and with the disturbances. And so place-based policy, to use a very wonky term, I think is now really taking center stage. And we do get this sort of sense of, you know, is this my place? Is this a community that welcomes me? Am I safe here? That actually, it's a reminder that we live in physical places, that we're physical entities. We're not brains on a stick. And so the feeling of our spaces and places, I think, really has come out very strongly from the research. I was a Boy Scout volunteer as well. So we're all sort of coming out with our scouting histories, but had some of the same tensions with it that you identified, which is this kind of imperialistic view. But actually, you know, the youngest scout motto, at least when I was there, well, the first thing was be kind or do a good turn. Right? These are sort of incredibly arcane sounding phrases, but actually it's why Boy Scouts of America was formed, was because an American visiting London was helped by a scout through the fog of London and said, why did you do that? And he said, because I've been trained that I should just be kind to strangers. And the kindness of strangers isn't a bad way to think about civic infrastructure. And the last point, I just want to clarify my line about civility. I want to be clear that civility as a value is used differently by different groups. I'm just aware that there are some people who would use civility to argue against the necessarily messy business of protest. We have to be clear that progress and justice is very often a messy, messy business. It sometimes requires, in fact, it almost always requires things to get broken. Laws get broken sometimes in the pursuit of justice. Windows often get broken by the minority. And so I'm just conscious of the fact that civility, in the sense that Rebecca and I think Andre are using it, and i.e. listening to others, I'm actually Mill's biographer, John Stuart Mill's biographer. So the idea of free speech is dear to me, but as they both say, it's listening that makes free speech valuable, not speaking. So I completely agree with everything they've said. I'm just aware this idea of civility can sometimes imply that the messiness and unpredictability and the stuff getting broken and noisy and difficult and uncomfortable, you know, is not what we mean here. And that is misused by some. So I just want to clarify that as well.
Thanks very much, Richard. That was an important point. And, you know, I think that, you know, that motto of Boy Scouts, I mean, the Girl Guides had the same thing. You have to do a good turn every day. And I still do that, you know, now. If I see somebody who needs help across the road, I kind of rush off to help. And I've had my daughter going, "Mom, what are you doing?" You know, because often in America, you know, grabbing someone by the arm to help them across the road might be taken the wrong way. And it's just a kind of an instinct from being in the Girl Guides of, you know, if you sort of see somebody who needs some help with something, you rush to do it. And, you know, I think it's sad that it's taken, you know, the wrong way these days. And that's actually, you know, part of the issue that we're trying to deal with. Andrew, I think I'd like to come back to you because there's a good segue there from what Richard was saying about the importance of place. And your book is really about how, you know, some of these places where people are, their community, they're underfunded and they're not respected in the ways that other people's communities are. And we've had one question in the list here about the relationship between the community and the police. I mean, clearly this has really deteriorated. Right. And we'd all talked before we went live about this kind of question. And I was recalling, you know, as a kid growing up in the UK, after a lot of the riots that actually Richard was referring to, you know, quite recently in Britain, but, you know, they were going on in the 80s when I was at school. Our local police forces actually tried to do more outreach to the community. Funding was actually switched away from just the law and order aspects of police, but to more community work. And some police forces actually had whole members of their corps who actually were community policemen and women. And that was their job, not going out and basically enforcing law and order, but to go into schools, talking to kids, keeping, you know, kids away from trouble at the very beginning, but also kind of playing more of a role and, you know, on public safety issues. And, you know, Andre, it would be really interesting to, you know, see if you've been thinking about that in, I mean, obviously this is a pretty fraught time, but yeah. This is also an occasion perhaps to, you know, think afresh about this again.
Yeah, I've been saying all the time that there's nothing that says a black person doesn't belong in an economy like a cop choking them out in the middle of the street in broad daylight. That so much about civics education is about who belongs in society and who does not. Because, yes, I agree that we should be arguing all the time, debating all the time. And in some instances, we should be protesting a great deal. But nothing really works. Those arguments don't work if you don't belong, if the assumption is you don't belong here. And I think that's what is occurring all across the country. We have opportunities for schools and other institutions to respond to this moment and affirmatively. But in the past, schools, universities, other institutions have not broken this this cycle of blacks don't belong. And for me, the projects we take on in civic education, they have to be place-based because that's where injustice occurs. That's how we live our lives, no question. But those projects have to answer questions around how can we get people who've been ostracized by society to belong in society. And you do that first and foremost by creating the structural inequalities. You know, I say this loosely, but I do mean it. I could care less about holding hands with my brothers and sisters than I want to see that housing devaluation change. That I want to see those outcomes around policing changed. For me, if you don't have that architecture of inequality solved, you won't solve for these greater problems.
Fiona, can I say a word? On this issue of policing and belonging, and then going back to the notion of community cohesion and ultimately civic engagement, I have a very close friend who is of a different political party than I am, different political persuasion, and holds a very senior position actually in the current Trump government. And over a dinner party once several years ago, after he'd had a few drinks, we got to this question of police killing. Actually, I now remembered it was after one of these other, I can't remember which one, but after another killing of an unarmed black man by a police officer.
There's a statement. Right there. I don't remember which one.
Yeah, it's like, look, Ruben, here's the thing. I mean, it's like black people only care when black people are killed by white cops. Why is that the issue as opposed to ongoing black on black violence in Chicago or any other place? And I said to him two things. First of all, of course, we all care about black on black violence, just like white on white violence, which is where the majority of homicides come from. But the reason it's different for police officers killing unarmed black men is because it goes to the foundational question of the republic. Who is a citizen? Indeed, who is even human? And can we expect as citizens to be treated equally by the agents of the state? And the reason that for me, the killing of Maude Aubrey is at least as compelling, if not more so, than just the sheer brutality of the killing of George Floyd, is because these people who were self-appointed guardians of belonging in a white neighborhood of Georgia preemptively decided that Ahmaud Arbery didn't belong there, that they could act as instruments of the state, that they could kill him inadvertently or however you want to sort of think about it, and that the state preemptively, prima facie, took their side and didn't charge them for 74 days and wouldn't have charged them had either the video not come out and had not the third DA in a row from Atlanta decided that this is something that needed to be looked into. And so this goes into, again, this foundational question of who are we as a community, literally who belongs. And quite frankly, to sort of bring it all back around to the points that Avril and Rebecca were talking about, this is why this is so fraught. Because many of our brother and sister citizens don't even want to hear this discussion. They look at the same fact pattern and simply going to the national security advisor of the president of the United States, who is on the record in the last few days saying there is no systemic problem with racism in American policing, notwithstanding all of the data. And so for me, this is why I think the really hard challenge is trying to figure out how do we even come to a baseline of values from which we can have a further conversation about what ought to be the content of our civic discussions and civic education as a means of building a stronger democracy.
This is a really important point, Ruben, and I'm sorry, I can't see who was trying to come in here, but I think it was just, I mean, basically, is that Rebecca, you were trying to come in as well, and Jonathan, because it gets to the issue that Jonathan raised about putting everything in historical context. And I think that, you know, what everyone is saying, you can't strip this out of the broader educational fabric either, because you have to understand exactly how this has come about. Anyway, Rebecca, do you want to come in and then Jonathan on this point?
Sure, because I think it's really, really important point. And to get a little more theoretical in the education theory of citizenship building, there's basically what Andre and Richard and Ruben were saying is, you know, you can't just talk the talk, you have to walk the walk too. And in the world of education, K through 12, there's what's called the explicit curriculum. So that's what's in the textbook, what's taught, and then there's the hidden curriculum. So it's hard for young people to take in, you know, this idea that we're all equal, you know, we're talking about justice at the moment, equal under the law, and then they go back to their neighborhoods and they see that we're not, or what can schools do about this? Or we have a, you know, what are policies around discipline in schools? We know that African-American boys in particular are absolutely disciplined and expelled at much larger numbers for the same infractions as white students. I mean, so it extends down to everything. So there are two parts to doing citizenship education in schools. One is the explicit curriculum and the other is the hidden curriculum. And I think that the explicit curriculum is where there's less debate. And I think it's the hidden curriculum because that gets to actual structural racism or structural sexism, or you can name it, but it's structures that keep kids from having an equal opportunities and experience, even within education, that can be quite contentious. And just to answer the part somebody asked about global citizenship, there's a couple of great examples. Two of the countries in the world that are doing are historically on our sort of watch list of doing great on citizenship in schools are Colombia in Latin America, who several years ago, they've been at civil war for decades, several years ago said, oh my gosh, looks like for the first time in decades and decades, we are going to be in a country without a civil war. And our people, our students, our people have no skills to be able to live in peacetime and be able to work in peacetime. And they actually have, as part of their national curriculum, they have an entire citizenship assessment for, you know, it's right alongside reading and math, et cetera. The one thing I will say there, it's, you know, it gets to Ruben's point is, I remember we've done projects on global citizenship and worked with different countries around the world to try to figure out what the core competencies are. And Colombia was one of them. And at one point, the government got a little scared because there was a big consultative process. Groups came up with how you should assess being a good citizen. And a lot of it came, there was a lot of critical thinking, critical dialogues, looking at structural inequality, and that made them very, very nervous. So we, and they rolled back actually and said, you know what, we don't want them thinking that critically. So it is actually a tension between what Jonathan was saying. It's not really that we don't know what to do. It's how do you give political leaders the safe space to be able to do that, knowing that it might, you know, become very, very messy.
So just
thanks, Jonathan, go ahead. Yeah.
Quick comment, because I thought that Ruben's sort of response to his friend at the dinner party was quite important and profound to help people understand the difference. And I think one thing that pops into my mind to say is I think one of the reasons why, honestly, white people or a majority is responding differently at this moment is this unique alchemy of videos that came together at once. So you had the Arbery video. I don't think enough attention is paid to that Christian Cooper Central Park video, because what that showed is that everybody watched what that woman did and we all knew exactly what she was doing. We all knew exactly what she was doing, and we all knew in that instant this always pounding sub basement of racial inequity that we all live upon, and it's the stability of our footing is right there, and it was all manifestly obvious in that instant second. And then right after that we see it dramatically with the murder of George Floyd reinforced. And so the coming together of those things underscores the reality and underscores our tacit acceptance of that reality. And we were opened up to being educated. And that's the main point I want to sort of underscore, which is education, everything that we're talking about only happens if people are open to it. And by the way, like, there was probably a glass of wine or two before Ruben gave that explanation, which made that conversation possible. Whereas other people might not.
But it's all good. Yeah.
but you know what I'm saying, right? That actually helped in a way. You got to find that perfect balance. One or two glasses helps, and then you go off the wrong direction, right? But we need to figure out how to do this and have these conversations where everybody's not defensive and accusatory and resistant to learning. And that gets to this civility question. One of the benefits that I'm an East Coast guy, you know, New York, Washington, Carter. I've benefited tremendously by being in Arizona because you can't make assumptions about what the person next to you thinks. We've got the full range of political and social beliefs, and you can't judge somebody by their skin color either in terms of what their political beliefs are. So every conversation has to be framed in such a way that people are open to the idea of learning, and you're not making assumptions about how they're coming into the conversation. And if we're going to use service as a bridge towards civic education and addressing some of these issues, it has to be approached in such a way that you retain and indeed cultivate that openness, or it won't accomplish the things that we're hoping that it will accomplish, that, you know, Ruben talked about at the beginning, that we know the solutions. But once the doors drop and people are closed, it doesn't matter. Like, they're not listening, they're not learning, they're not hearing all the things that have been mentioned before.
One of the things about opening doors, I mean, we've had a question, we had it in the webinar on May 4th, and we didn't really tackle it. You know, I've been asking about nonprofits and, you know, junior achievement, Boy Scouts, Girl Scouts. But we often get a question about artists and public art. And we could also put this out to celebrities and sports figures as well. We've seen an awful lot of people stepping into this space and opening doors. I just saw on the internet recently one of the country stars sharing a beer, you know, and sort of sitting down to have these kinds of conversations that maybe you wouldn't normally, you know, to try to kind of open a door. And I think obviously art opens doors. Sometimes art is on doors and it's on walls, and, you know, murals and other public art can have a, you know, major impact here, and they're in public spaces and communities. I mean, here in DC, there's a very vibrant public art movement that, you know, we can all see, and, you know, out west as well, places like Los Angeles and, you know, and elsewhere. So I wonder if anybody would like to come in on this and think about how public art, artists can open doors and try to sort of strengthen civic bonds here. Because often, getting on Richard's point about dream harders, art, you know, kind of music, particularly if it's classical music or it's art in museums, is often seen again as something that is for the privileged. I have a friend back home in the UK who's actually trying to open up museums and all of their collections for kids that would never go inside a museum, that their school doesn't have the funding to, you know, take them on school trips, and is trying to get museums. I mean, God knows how this will work now with the pandemic, but in actual fact, you now have collections now online, but to try to kind of get a kid who would never get a chance to go inside of a museum to be able to go in there and to sort of see, you know, what's available. So I don't know if Andre, Ruben or Richard or anybody wants to also come in on this for this kind of specific question.
Well, I wasn't a Boy Scout, and so that might be my problem right now. But I will say that I was a member of the orchestra, and I did play sports. And what I learned in the orchestra, one, it allowed me to meet different people I probably would not have come in contact with. But it, more importantly, we could see the physical sort of manifestation of working together, being on reading from the same sheet music. Now, what's missing in public education now, in my opinion, is that whereas religious organizations or religious schools have sort of the Bible or the Quran or whatever as their moral doctrine, I honestly don't see that moral doctrine of the Constitution in schools. Either it's presented in a hyper political way, or it's not touched at all in fear that it doesn't address minority groups. And so what I think is missing is sort of this moral, this doctrine that people can then read from the same sort of score, so to speak, that we can then rally behind something together. And that's what I think is missing from public schools in particular.
That's a really great point, Andre, and an excellent metaphor. And having also been in a orchestra, and not a very good orchestra, I have to say, there's nothing worse when you're all playing out of tune and, you know, not following along with the score. It's painful for everybody. And that's kind of really where we are now. It's painful for everybody. And I think that's a really important point that you've made there. I mean, unfortunately, we haven't got a lot more time here. And I think, you know, what I hope is that we'll be able to do some more of these events as we move forward. I mean, I know all of our Brookings colleagues have a lot to say on this. I do hope that everyone will buy Andre's book and also Rebecca's and Richard's, and, you know, hopefully, you know, we'll, Jonathan will be able to share with everyone more of an idea of what they have done at ASU and the Watts School to really deal with a very diverse student body and to really kind of try to put this into action. And Jonathan has actually sort of said to me in the chat here that Watts College is trying to work with their arts college to put this into action. But as I say, it has to, as Andre has said, really have a sense of what you're trying to do here, not just trying to do it for the sake of promoting the arts, but exactly to get people to have what Jonathan was also saying as well about the practice of working together. And I mean, Ruben, I'm sure, you know, we'll be all watching you very closely with your new position. I'm a very important position at the University of the South at a very important time. To wrap up, I'd like to go back to Avril, because Avril, maybe you could tell us a little bit about, you know, with the commission going, you know, out of business, so to speak, you obviously want the business of thinking about public service and what we can do to move forward. So perhaps you might have some thoughts about what all of us could be doing. And again, I mean, I'd like to try to capture, and I know that my Brookings colleagues will be doing that, some of the very important points that have been made here, but you perhaps have some closing thoughts for us.
Yeah, and if it's all right, I'd like to just say a thing or two on the artist piece too. You know, there's such a long history, and I know everybody knows this, but of art being used as a method of protest. And I think it is one of the most extraordinary ways of communicating in many respects. And it gets very much to, I think, something that both Ruben and Andre mentioned in different ways. This kind of, you know, Ruben said, talked about the need for a baseline of values. And, you know, and Andre's comment just now about a sort of a very similar thing.
We might have lost. And, oh, there you are, Avril. You're back. Sorry. We
almost lost. Oh, sorry. It says my internet connection is unstable, so hopefully I won't cut out again. But basically, to say that art and the fact that we need to actually adjust the culture, and when people talk to us about, you know, can service overcome racism, I think it can be part of the solution, but it's not going to eradicate racism. The reality is we're going to need to do an enormous amount of work to address the systemic racism in our country. And I think, you know, obviously others have spoken to this point. I do think that service can actually be part of the solution in the following ways, and just to sort of highlight them. I think through service and through civics action, you essentially have an opportunity to engender empathy and to really start to understand how people who are not like you, who live in different communities, who live in different circumstances, how they see the world, and have an opportunity to recognize that and maybe bring value to each other through that process. A second piece of it from my perspective is through civics action and through service, there's a sense of empowerment. It's, you know, a sense of, it's not just about the history lessons, and people have noticed, it's actually about going through the process and seeing that through your action, you can make change. You can address the challenges that, in fact, you see in your society and that you see injustice. Well, you know, this is a way in which to try to actually change it. And it is frequently not nearly as successful as it ought to be, but there is nevertheless the opportunity, and the more we push on those spaces, the more opportunities we have, particularly if we change the infrastructure to actually have a more inclusive and diverse service and civics action sort of, you know, space within which to operate. So those are two pieces. A third piece that I think is complicated but worth mentioning is really the opportunity to have coherence in the society. And this is one that, you know, in many respects, to the global citizen point, when we went around the country, we saw how many young people were interested in volunteering and in doing service and in helping their communities. Extraordinary passion for these issues, but they are focused locally and globally, and they tend not to be focused nationally. And creating that sense of we are in this together and recognizing that we have these common experiences, I think, is critical. Even though I recognize, and this was a conversation we had explicitly with many of them, how much distrust they have in the government. And some of it is justified. And it's a question of really sort of changing it through these processes and seeing if we can actually evolve into the society that they want to be. So I think that's a piece of what all of this brings together. In terms of next steps and the commission and what we hope for, frankly, the most important thing that could happen next is that legislation be passed, that Congress take action to fund many of the programs that we know need to be funded, that, you know, so many of the 164 recommendations that we've made get acted on in order to create the opportunities that we're talking about. So thank you so much. Really fascinating conversation. Enjoyed listening to it.
Thank you very much, Avalon. Thank you to all of the panelists. And as I said, I hope we'll be able to do some more of these discussions. And we'd like to wish Ruben all the very best as he moves on to his new position. Thank Jonathan for all the work that ASU is doing. And, you know, hopefully people can check out on the ASU website some of the curricula. Richard, thank you, you know, very much for joining us and, you know, giving the perspective based on all the work that you've been doing. Andre, every best wish for your book, and you know, hope that people will pay attention to this. And similarly with Rebecca, who's got her book on leapfrogging inequality. There's a lot of great research there in all of these works from our colleagues that I think, you know, we can hopefully, you know, as Avril says, as we look at some of the legislation, we get more resources. Some of the recommendations there can also see their way to being implemented. I'd like to thank everybody else for joining us and from all of the questions. I think one way or another, we did touch on many of the questions that we got through. Many clearly very engaged and serious participants in this webinar today. And thank you very much to everyone. Really appreciate it. Thank you.
Thanks, Fiona.
Bye-bye.
Thank you, Fiona. Bye.